is Liberation Radio.
Capitalism needs poverty.
A world run by a handful of greedy bankers and CEOs who nobody elected can't possibly last.
Whatever we could do, we're going to do, especially in continuing to preserve this earth.
Each week, we bring you interviews, commentary, analysis, political developments, and struggles affecting workers throughout the country as a way to build the movement for socialism in the United States.
The revolution will be broadcast.
The only thing that will ever defeat racism will be the defeat of its parents, capitalism and imperialism.
Without smashing mass incarceration, working people of all nationalities cannot have justice.
Liberation Radio is brought to you by the Party for Socialism and Liberation.
Welcome to Liberation Radio, podcast of the Party for Socialism and Liberation. Each week we bring you news and analysis affecting the struggles of poor and working people in the United States with a view towards socialism. I'm your host, Marcel Cartier. This week we go inside the Black Radical Tradition Conference held last weekend at Temple University in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. We speak to PSL member Eugene Perrier about what made this year's conference so significant. We also turn to Oregon and are joined by Jacqueline Keeler, an Indigenous Peoples activist, for a perspective on events taking place with the armed takeover of the Malheur Wildlife Refuge by a right-wing grouping known as the Patriot Militia. But first, we go to Philadelphia for some audio from the Black Radical Tradition Conference held at Temple University.
We are all here to learn, to teach, and to grow. As the old proverb goes, steel sharpens steel. And as we use this weekend to become sharpened in preparation for the next stage of struggle, let us not forget who we are and why we've come. Today we're sitting in a room on the campus of Temple University in North Philadelphia. Here in North Philly is where the first Black community of homeowners lived in Yorktown.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It was here in North Philly where the Columbia Avenue uprisings took place. And it was here in North Philly, where the historic Church of the Advocate is located and many other beautiful historic churches and landmarks. It was here in North Philly where the Cecil B. Moore Freedom Fighters at the ages of 13, 14, and 15 years old stood on the side of justice to integrate Girard College, and it was here in North Philly where everything under the sun is happening every single day. North Philly is a universe. It's a whole other world. It's a whole other entity within itself. And we're here today where everything, anywhere, is happening right here. Temple University is the largest arbiter of violence and injustice here in North Philadelphia. And this is where we are. We're here. We're sitting in the building. At Temple, they do not see a Black community. They do not see the people at Yorktown. They do not see the Cecil B. Moore Freedom Fighters, and they definitely do not see the Church of the Advocate. In fact, at Temple, they're completely oblivious to the universe outside of the walls. Temple builds invisible barriers around 12th Street, 11th Street. They like to extend it sometimes. Like, I think it's about the extent of like 9th Street. 9th Street, at 17th Street, you don't go past those blocks. You don't go past, you don't go past Susquehanna. You don't go to New York. You don't go past Cecil B. Moore. You don't, or Oxford. You don't go past the supermarket, right? And these invisible barriers, if you are a student with any sense, you'll stay within the gates. You'll stay within the thresholds. And the thresholds read Templetown. But if you're a resident of North Philadelphia like me, the signs on those gates read very clearly and explicitly, "Nigger, keep out." As both a student and a resident here, I see both the instructions to keep out and the instructions to come on in, come into Templetown. I see both of these things as a Black student here. And Temple has done this, has created this relationship with Black students in the Black community as well, by effectively erecting an African American studies department that has no connection with North Philadelphia. And even a less capacity for the resistance that is needed in this space. I am a black student in a black tradition in African American studies, and I was urged not to protest in African American studies. They told me, oh, there's no sense of protesting. You just need to, you know, get good grades so you can get a degree, so you can get out of here, so you can get your PhD in African American studies. For what? Y'all don't do anything.
But I wanted to talk about Haiti, and I want us to acknowledge the fact that in this part of the world, Haiti is the historical forger of the black radical tradition. Toussaint Louverture, Jacques Dessalines, it was in Haiti that the world's first non-racial democracy emerged. In other words, the first democracy. Democracy in the U.S., democracy in France was democracy of the elite. Elite democracy, which should be oxymoronic, but the prevailing recognition of democracy failed to acknowledge the irreconcilable opposition of the terms elites and democracy.
The second major source for the black radical tradition's internationalism was the communist movement. You cannot imagine black thought in the United States without the communist and socialist tradition. It's inconceivable to write a history of the black radical tradition without the special emphasis that black communists played to enlarge the vision not only of the black radical tradition, but of communism. Because communism, and by which I mean the Communist International, the Comintern would have been lesser without the impact of American and other black communists inside it from the very beginning.
That's right.
You know, it wasn't, and I think this is part of the anti-communist tradition that has grown in intellectual circles, the assumption somehow that communism is a white movement is what they say. But we know that this is not true. Communism from its very beginning was the tradition of the toilers and the oppressed. And they fought to create it in their image. So when you travel, for instance, across the African continent, or when you travel in Asia, or when you travel in South America, when you encounter communism, it doesn't look like the books you read in the United States. They talk about people you've never heard of. But they see them as central characters in their communist journey. So without understanding the black radical tradition and its internationalism, you will be in danger of parochializing it and cutting off one of your own limbs. This is your heritage.
Since the 2008 Great Recession, the vast majority of American people live under harsh government-enforced austerity policies, which cut into every form of welfare for the people, including food and education, social security, housing, unemployment relief, Medicare, and Medicaid. This while, in the same period, the government and the Federal Reserve and Treasury doled out close to $30 trillion to the financial oligarchs, large banks and corporations. Trade deals have been signed which ship jobs out of the country and permit so-called offshore tax havens for the billionaire class. The 1% have taken complete control of the economy, the political system, academic and intellectual life, and turned art towards superficial entertainment and profit. All of this, all of this has produced a collective consciousness disproportionately among whites that upholds war, white supremacy, police terror and murder, repression, economic inequality, violence against women, and people who don't fit the gender normality. Again, while the 1% lavishly benefited from government welfare and handouts, the majority is forced to live under government-imposed austerity. Actual unemployment and poverty are way beyond anything government statistics acknowledge. When they say 5%, double it. And when you double it in general, triple it or quadruple it for black folks. In the face of the growing distress of the people, the ruling oligarchs have unleashed a reign of police terror, murder, and violence upon ordinary people, disproportionately among the black poor and working class. Black communities, as we all know, are under assault by a vast police state, and local police forces again operate as occupying armies. Mass incarceration of black and brown young people is the ruling elite's answer to the collapse of the real economy and of public education. Communities of working people are being destroyed as real estate speculators, bankers, universities, and others connive with local government officials to ruthlessly gentrify neighborhoods and displace large numbers of people. The same elites propose global policies of what they call full-spectrum warfare, by which they mean endless war on all continents. They have brought the world near to all-out nuclear war. Alongside this, a vast, secretive, and lavishly funded and unaccountable so-called government has emerged, known as the National Security State.
And now we turn to Eugene Perrier, a member of the Party for Socialism and Liberation who attended the Black Radical Tradition Conference at Temple University in Philadelphia. If you could just begin by telling us about the Black Radical Tradition Conference that you attended last weekend.
Yeah, so the Black Radical Tradition Conference, which took place in Philadelphia in the early part of January, was a conference brought together by a number of young folks in Philadelphia who had been organizing around a number of different issues in both the Black Lives Matter movement for Black Lives ecosystem, but also a number of anti-imperialist causes, gentrification, and so on and so forth. And the conference itself was, you know, really a fantastic conference. It brought together both a lot of people from, you know, what I guess you could call the younger activist generation that's been awakened since Black Lives Matter, and those of us like myself who are younger, but have been active, you know, really maybe since the Iraq War era and so on and so forth, with a lot of the more well-known activists and organizers and academics, black activist organizers and academics, who have been a part of, you know, what's known as the Black Radical Tradition, which has a lot of different connotations to different people, but by and large basically denotes sort of the left wing of the Black Liberation Movement in so many ways, and especially its socialist manifestations and the different ways that has broken down. And so you had a number of people there. You had Cornel West, Robin D.G. Kelly, Reverend Jeremiah Wray, Dr. Anthony Montero, who is sort of the patron of the conference in Philadelphia, and did a lot to help put it on, Jamala Rogers from the Organization of Black Struggle, Angela Davis, who maybe I already said, just a number of people in that vein, as you can imagine, Larry Hamm, People's Organization of Progress in Newark. So a very wide representation on both sides, both the panels. Mamia Abu-Jamal also spoke, I should mention. Wide representation on the panels and inside of the attendees themselves. People really came from all over the country, even though it was primarily East Coast. I would say, you know, maybe just over 1,000 people were there. It was packed. I mean, definitely there were overflow rooms, the whole nine. So, you know, I would almost say this was the second national gathering of the Movement for Black Lives after the Cleveland Movement for Black Lives Conference, this Black Radical Tradition Conference. Brother Umi Sala was there from the Dream Defenders. Names are just popping up to me as I talk because it was such a dynamic conference with so much going on. And I think that it was great to have it, especially following on the heels of the Cleveland Convention where, you know, there's a lot of people doing work, but we're not all connected, to have another opportunity for people to talk and really to have a very political conference where we were able to not just meet and talk about the work in particular, but some of the ideology behind the work.
And you may already have elucidated on some of this, you know, but what, in your view, is the significance of this particular conference, you know, especially if you compare it to perhaps other conferences of the same sort of caliber that occurred in the past? You know, what made this particular one at Temple such a big deal?
Well, I think this one was a little bit more political, which is not really a criticism in some ways of the Cleveland Conference. I mean, it is and it isn't. I mean, but I think that ultimately what we saw in this conference, and that's what I really want to focus on, is that, you know, there was a heavy, strong political emphasis. And it wasn't everyone unified around the same political line. I mean, I think certainly the conference itself, the organizers, a lot of us who were attending, most of the speakers were sort of more in line with what I just mentioned in terms of the Black radical tradition. I think some people were newer activists who, you know, aren't that ideological because they're just learning. And so they're looking to find out new things. And I think in between those two issues, what you had was a really good sort of exchange of ideas and views. And even, and I know some people who are listening to this would have heard, you know, there are some contradictions in the conference where some people had some disagreements over, you know, whether or not, or basically how it was put together and what, you know, how it was going about. But even those disagreements, I think, were creative tension. It was a lot of creative tension about what does it mean to be a Black radical? What is the Black radical tradition? And how does this relate to the movement? I mean, should our movement even be radical? Because there are some who are out there, if you look at a prominent Black Lives Matter activist, D. Ray McKesson, for instance, Sean King, and, you know, they're sort of policy focused. They're looking at making changes in the system, and some of those changes make a lot of sense. But what is that? A lot of that was in the conversation of, you know, that distinction between that historical, long-term, worldwide discussion about reform versus revolution, and should our movements be radical, and if they are, how do they, you know, intersect with struggles for reform? And a lot of these things were what were being discussed. And, you know, I don't know if there was anything definitive that was decided, and I don't really necessarily think that there needed to be. I think that it was just, you know, in this movement so far, the Movement for Black Lives, Black Lives Matter ecosystem, whatever you want to call it. Obviously, this, I mean, I think in reality, the new wave of the Black liberation movement that has been existing since we Black people came to this country in 1619, we've been able to, you know, inject into the conversation the idea that not just Black Lives Matter, but that Black liberation is back, you know, that Black liberation politics are, you know, something that everyone from Hillary Clinton on down have to reckon with. But what we haven't done is deepen the conversation politically and start to talk about the implications of a lot of what we are doing and to dialogue with each other politically. I think a lot of what's been going on is that people have been doing work and linking with each other, doing work, and, you know, talking about the enemy, as it were. But we haven't been doing a lot of talking amongst each other about what our beliefs are, what our contradictions are. And I think that this conference, you know, whatever you thought about the broader piece, whether you loved it, whether you had some contradictions, it started that conversation. And I think that is extremely important, that we start to push forward and have these conversations in a way that is meaningful and that really advances the work. I mean, I think if you look at the civil rights movement, it wasn't all one group. So it doesn't have to be all one group, all with one point of view to accomplish a lot around these issues that we have raised up, whether it be police terror, whether it be, you know, all the other issues affecting the urban Black oppressed population. Also, how do we link with other oppressed peoples, Latino people in this country, other oppressed peoples in this country, other oppressed peoples around the world? The issue of Palestine was very high on the agenda. And there was a lot of concrete solidarity with Palestine, I would say universally held throughout the conference, as far as I could tell. If anyone was against it, they certainly were not saying anything. And so how do we manage that relationship? And so, you know, it was interesting on a lot of different scores to see these conversations start to happen, sort of the fruits of this conference, I think, will only be seen in the future to the extent that we kind of continue to carry forth these arguments. If folks go to theblackradicaltradition.org, theblackradicaltradition.org, they can see video of the whole conference. So they don't just have to hear it from me. They can check it all out for themselves on the website that the organizers put up.
With all of that violence that they display at the international level, when you and I want just a little bit of freedom, we're supposed to be nonviolent. They're violent. They're violent in Korea. They're violent in Germany. They're violent in the South Pacific. They're violent in Cuba. They're violent wherever they go. But when it comes time for you and me to protect ourselves against lynchers, they tell us to be nonviolent.
For nearly 2 weeks, members of the Patriot Militia Organization, now calling themselves Citizens for Constitutional Freedom, have been occupying federal property in Oregon called the Malheur Natural Wildlife Refuge. The occupants say that they're there to support ranchers Dwight and Stephen Hammond, who are facing 5 years in prison for arson on federal land. While the ranchers claim they have the right to the land, the indigenous people's community has been vocal about who that land really belongs to. Joining us from Oregon to help us gain some insight into the history of the Malheur Refuge is Jacqueline Keeler. Keeler is a writer and activist of Diné and Yankton Dakota heritage. Keeler co-founded Eradicating Offensive Native Masketry, which seeks to end the use of racial groups as mascots, as well as other stereotypical representations in popular culture. Thanks for joining us, Jacqueline.
Yes, good to be here. Thank you.
So could you start by telling us a little bit about the history of this area in eastern Oregon where the occupation by the Bundy brothers and the Patriot Militia is taking place? What is the actual history of the Malheur Wildlife Refuge itself?
Yes, the refuge was originally part of the Malheur Indian Reservation, which was negotiated by treaty with the Northern Paiute tribes, which include the Burns Paiute tribe, which is the present-day federally recognized entity in the area.
And what about the indigenous communities that lived in Oregon in the past? And what happened to this land? How is it that it actually came to change hands?
Yes, I don't think most people are not aware of the level of genocide that occurred both in Oregon and in California. The genocide was extremely devastating to the tribes in those states. And in Oregon, they estimate that by 1900, 95% of all Indians were killed. And so you have a tribe like the Northern Paiute, and they estimate that in the early 1860s, they had about 2,000 tribal members there in the Burns, Oregon area. And after genocidal war conducted by the U.S. Army, their numbers were halved, and then 500 were then marched in the late 1870s all the way to Yakima, Washington, the Yakima Indian Reservation, which is about 350 miles away in the snow in January. And you can see from the pictures at the Malheur Wildlife Refuge how snowy it is, and there are a couple of mountain ranges between Yakima and the Yakima Nation and the Paiute homelands.
What about this particular standoff that's been taking place for almost 2 weeks now? I mean, you know, the Bundy brothers have been getting a significant amount of media attention. You know, there's no confrontation with the federal government that's taken place yet. Certainly, you know, even in the mainstream, there's been you know, stories about how if this would have been an African-American armed group or an indigenous people's armed group, you know, it may have been a completely different conclusion already. So how is the indigenous community in Oregon, how are they relating to what's taking place at the moment?
Yeah, I think that most, you've seen the comments from the tribal chairperson, Charlotte Roderick, and definitely they see that if they had, she has been quoted saying that if they had taken over the refuge, they would be dead by now. And certainly that the armed response when people of color, as you can see in Ferguson, and as Native people have taken taking control of things, I think the two main comparisons have been Wounded Knee, in where a U.S. postal post office was taken over in Wounded Knee, South Dakota, on the Oglala Lakota Sioux Reservation in the 1970s. There was like a full armed response, and then later in the 1990s, when the Shoshone stood up against a pair of sisters on the Shoshone Nation in Nevada, tried to do what Bundy did, was stop the BLM for taking their cattle. There was an armed response.
Well, you mentioned Wounded Knee in 1973, which I think is a very powerful and a glaring example of the kind of double standard around the way that, you know, this particular occupation is handled. You know, Leonard Peltier is considered by many to be one of the longest held political prisoners in the country. And, you know, I was at the White House just, you know, days before the new year, and there was another protest taking place for his release. What would you say is the state of the, not only the indigenous, you know, communities in Oregon, but throughout the United States at the moment? What are some of the most pressing issues that indigenous people face?
Yeah, I think the main issues have centered around the issues relating to sovereignty, the recognition of sovereignty one of the big issues is, and we share a lot of the same issues with First Nations in Canada. One of the big issues is the missing and murdered Indigenous women issue. The hashtag is MMIW, missing and murdered Indigenous women. And the rates are high both in Canada and the United States. The Department of Justice released a 2010 paper which found that Native women had 2.5 times the rate of murder and rape of any other ethnic group in the United States, and that nearly 80% of these rapes and murders were done by white men outside of their race, which is very unusual. Normally, these heinous acts are done by men of their own race.
So one of the campaigns that you've been involved in, I know, is called Eradicating Offensive Native Masquerade. Where I am right now in Washington, D.C., obviously, we have a professional football team, which, you know, has a very racist name, and there's been a campaign around changing the name of the team for quite a few years now. Could you maybe expound upon, you know, some of the work that you've done in co-founding that particular organization and how important this is?
Yes. Our organization takes on the issue of stereotyping and the harm that it causes Native people. And masquerade is a term that I coined, which refers to all the practices associated with having a Native mascot. Often people will look at a Native mascot and think, well, it doesn't look bad, it's rather noble looking. But the truth is, what is done with that mascot is the problem. Whether it's fans dressing up in red face at games, or it is the promotion of stereotypes about Native people, to the exclusion of any other kind of portrayal of Native people in the media. Often people will say, well, you know, what about Vikings or the Fighting Irish? But the comparison doesn't hold up because that's not the only way that white people are portrayed in the media. And if it was, then the comparison would hold. If the only time you ever saw a white man on TV was as a Viking or a leprechaun, then you would have a comparative situation. Native people are only seen in stereotypical ways in the media and in sports. And there are no other examples shown, and particularly not modern examples.
I just want to end off by asking you one more question, returning to the occupation that's taking place at the Malheur Wildlife Refuge. When you were writing about the Cliven Bundy standoff back in 2014, you wrote that if the Nevada rancher is forced to pay taxes or grazing fees, he should pay them to the Shoshone. Could you expand upon what you meant by that?
Yes, actually where the Bundy's ranch is in Nevada, that land is unceded land, just like the land in Oregon where his son, Eamon Bundy, is holding the wildlife refuge hostage. That is also unceded land. The tribe in Nevada is the Shoshone Nation. They signed a treaty with the United States, but that treaty did not include any lands, any land giveaways. And so the land, their traditional territory, was actually never legally ceded. All they gave was passage through their lands.